With the latest agriculture news from across the state and nation, it's time for the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. Here's your host, Danielle Leal.
Hey everyone, Danielle Leal here, and thanks for getting your agriculture news with me today. Snowmelt renews flooding fears as Tulare Lake rises. The onset of warm temperatures is accelerating snowmelt and triggering worries about continued flooding in the Central Valley from a record-breaking snowpack accumulated during winter and spring storms. In Tulare County, farm fields have been inundated as floodwaters and snowmelt fill lowlands of the former Tulare Lake. Tulare County Agricultural Commissioner Jimmy Hook said flooding impacts the county have affected 64,000 acres, causing $131 million in financial losses. He said he expects damages to extend to 115,000 acres and losses to grow to $300 million. That was today's California Farm Bureau Food and Farm News Report, and now let's get into today's show headlines. Proposed legislation for allied industries and its impacts on ag. Water, pesticides, workplace safety are among the first to come to mind when thinking of legislation and regulation in place that have a direct impact on the industry. But Stanislaus County Farm Bureau's Education and Outreach Director Anna Genasi says legislation to other industries can also have impact on the farming community.
Well, I know. So the last time we had a board meeting here, our sheriff, Jeff, was here, and he mentioned some things that are at play right now, bills that would take away their ability to run folks through the process or kind of tie their hands up when it comes to pressing charges. I'm sure Sergeant Brock can say this more eloquently than I. I don't work in law enforcement, but those are some really those are good things for the farming community to hear. It's why I appreciate our sheriff's office being so active with our Farm Bureau, because then we're able to get those messages out to our membership. You know, Farm Bureau is here as an advocacy organization, and it's not always water legislation or pesticide legislation that could negatively impact our industry. Sometimes it's these types of things from a rural crime perspective that we don't always think of. I'm sure Brock can say more about this, but I just think it's really great for us as a Farm Bureau organization to keep a pulse on these things as well.
Sergeant Brock Condit of Stanislaus County Sheriff's Department adds,
there are a couple of assembly bills that are being brought forth that would definitely affect the way that we do our job in apprehending criminals. And one of those is AB 742 that, you know, prohibits the use of an unleashed police canine. You know, I know from my time on the canine unit, many of our apprehensions were out in the farming community where thieves were out stealing stuff. And so you have to think that these, you know, these canines are able to use their sense of smell in such a way that we can't even comprehend. And so when someone runs from us out in the farming community, you know, one of these thieves takes off on foot, we're able to use the dogs to track them down. And without that, you know, without that ability, then a lot of people are going to get away. And it's also going to place the public in danger. It's going to place other officers in danger, because now we've lost that tool that goes in before us, right? The tool that is able to locate people by their sense of smell. I don't know if you guys remember or heard about the canine in San Joaquin that was killed. I believe it was last month or a couple of months ago, that was stabbed, you know, and the dog was going in on a search and located the bad guy, and the bad guy stabbed him to death. And so you have to think, if that's an officer going in first, then there's going to be a confrontation, right? And you're going to end up in what, you know, more than likely, if someone's trying to stab you, you're going to end up in a shooting situation. And so here, unfortunately, the dog, you know, the dog died, but you know, there was no shooting. You know, the suspect didn't get shot, and an officer didn't get stabbed. And, you know, unfortunately, this dog lost his life. But there's so many incidents like that. When a criminal goes to hide somewhere, they are an extreme threat, because now they're out of sight and they are going to see you way before you see them.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Farm employers' labor service compliance posters could save you thousands of dollars. Did you know that California lawmakers can be fined as much as $13,000 in government penalties if they don't have all the required employee and farm labor information posted for their workers? Avoid costly penalties and give yourself peace of mind knowing you are in full compliance with FELS posters. At only $175, this full set of laminated weatherproof posters eliminates the risk. Order yours at FELS.net.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal, tossing it right on over to Sabrina Halverson with today's National Spotlight.
In today's National Spotlight, as lawmakers continue pushing toward the 2023 Farm Bill, Representative Brad Finstad of Minnesota says as a fourth-generation farmer, he understands firsthand the needs of farmers, but he gains even more insights from talking to farmers in his district.
Yeah, so great question. One of the things that I just keep pounding the drum on is that we have to make sure that we don't screw this up in D.C., that this farm bill needs to be by the farmer and for the farmer. It needs to be by rural America and for rural America. So what I'm hearing from our farmers day in, day out, and as a farmer myself, I mean, I think there's a strong importance to prioritize crop insurance and protecting the crop insurance title. That risk management tool has been so important to young farmers, generational opportunities and changes in farm country. Very practically speaking, I hear it all the time that farmers are solidifying their relationship on the front end with their banks because of the crop insurance. They're using it as marketing decisions on the back end, and it's really a sustainable way to manage their farm. So I'm hearing that all the time, protect crop insurance, look at opportunities to enhance it, whether that's, price conversation, whether it's expanding it to different commodities, and how do we look at livestock when it comes to the crop insurance or risk management type model. I'm also hearing that as we approach the conversation on the conservation title to make sure that, those programs remain voluntary, that they're not directly tied to different practices and mandated practices. The farmers in southern Minnesota, again, are, the best environmentalists that I've ever met. I see it not just from the farm, but also from being involved in a soil laboratory. So that's a key component. The other overarching piece that I think goes beyond the farm bill is really the input side that we've seen. We in farm country haven't been immune to the high gas prices, the high input prices. I had a farmer tell me, that he instantly saw the inputs increase when Russia invaded Ukraine. And we felt that right there in little old southern Minnesota. And I know we felt that all over rural America. And so that's kind of an overarching conversation that transcends the farm bill.
On the topic of regulations on chemistries such as atrazine, Finstad had this.
We have less than 1% of Americans that are farmers. But yet we are asked and charged to feed the country and the world. And so that's a big task. But it's not only just feeding the world, but it's also making sure that there's consumer confidence in what we're providing. And so the tools that we have, the advancements that we've seen, the scientific advancements that, again, I mean, I challenge anyone to find me a better environmentalist than a farmer. I'm not putting more chemical on my field than I need. I am doing it at a very precise way. I'm testing my soil with sub-inch accuracy. I'm only feeding that corn crop the nutrients it needs to get the yield that I need to make sure I can make the money I'm going to make to keep my farm going for that next generation. And by the way, it needs to be better than I found it. And that's the mentality and the model that so many of us have in farm country. We have to tell that story, and we have to make sure that, again, we're not buckling to the misconceptions and the lack of knowledge in regards to the science. But we also have to make sure that we're constantly trying to, work on building that better mousetrap. We have become more and more efficient. We didn't need government to tell us to do it. You look at the tillage practices that we've done on our farm. I didn't need the government to come in and tell me to do the things I did. I knew because of advancements in technology on the equipment side, we had new opportunities to do things. Just this year, I installed precision electric drives on my planter. I'm going to plant each row at a different rate, and it's going to turn on and off when the GPS tells it to. I'm going to save tons of money with seed costs that way. And I didn't need anybody to tell me to do that. I invested in that because I knew that was going to be better for our farm for the long run.
That's today's National Spotlight. I'm Sabrina Halverson, AgNet West.
Thanks, Sabrina. And now for today's livestock report, here's Randall Wiseman.
Well, in today's livestock news, we are seeing a strong rebound in demand for U.S. beef in Mexico. U.S. Meat Export Federation's John Harith has more details.
U.S. beef exports to Mexico are off to a strong start in 2023. U.S. Meat Export Federation President and CEO Dan Hallstrom explained some of the factors driving this trend.
We're off to a very good start through 2 months in 2023. Beef exports from the U.S. are up 15% versus last year. And I think there's a couple of factors at work here. You have a definite rebound in the food service industry post-COVID. We realized some of that rebound in 2022, but we'll realize the rest of that rebound here in 2023. So having a food service sector, tourism, hotels, business hotels that are occupied. The other thing that's positive for Mexico is their competitive globally. While we've talked a lot about having a strong U.S. dollar in Asia, we have a little bit of the opposite in Mexico. So common cuts like chuck rolls, for example, the Mexican market might be a little more competitive than it has in the past vis-a-vis some of our export opportunities into the Asian markets. So this is a positive as well for U.S. beef. The chuck and the shoulder clod, for example, is a big market for shoulder clods. But the other primal that's really dependent upon Mexico from a value standpoint is the round, insides, outsides, knuckles.
USMEF Regional Director Gerardo Rodriguez says his team works to find beef cuts and dishes that appeal to consumers in different regions of Mexico.
Great dynamics in the west coast of the country using the chucks. Central part of Mexico, using the different rounds, especially the gooseneck, especially the bottom round. So every region in the country might be using different type of primals, but at the end of the day, that is what we're here for, to explore and develop new alternatives in order to give a better value for the cutout. Not only the middle meats. I mean, I know everybody likes the tomahawk and the ribeye and all those kind of cuts, but how can we substitute a nice steak, a nice barbecue, using the chuck? In a day-to-day basis, how can we give more value to the rounds?
For more, please visit USMEF.org. For the U.S. Meat Export Federation, I'm John Harith.
Thanks, John. And this week, the National Milk Producers Federation submitted a comprehensive proposal to USDA for modernizing the Federal Milk Marketing Order, or FMMO, system. The product of 2 years of examination and more than 150 meetings held to build consensus behind updates to a program that last saw significant changes back in 2000. NMPF President and CEO Jim Mulhern said dairy farmers and their cooperatives need a modernized Federal Milk Marketing Order system that works better for producers. Now, upon official acceptance, USDA will have 30 days to review the plan and decide whether and how to move forward with a federal order hearing to review the plan. Some of the highlights include updating dairy product manufacturing allowances and discontinuing the use of barrel cheese in the protein component price formula. Learn more about this on the NMPF website, nmpf.org. I'm Randall Wiseman for Agnet West.
You're listening to Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
You're going to need me.
You're going to need us.
All of us.
You're going to need our help with your water, your air, your food.
You're going to need our determination,
our compassion.
You're going to need the next generation of leaders to face the challenges the future will bring.
And we promise we'll be there when you need us.
Today, 4-H is growing the next generation of leaders. Support us at 4-H.org.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
A look into the nutrients we are taking in and how they compare to federal recommendations. That's coming up on This Land of Ours. U.S. consumers' intake of several key nutrients differ from federal recommendations. Researchers from USDA's Economic Research Service examined diet patterns based on density, amounts of nutrients consumed per 1,000 calories, using the latest available National Food Consumption Survey data, which was collected in 2017 and 18. They compared average consumption densities of six nutrients with what would be needed to match Dietary Guidelines for Americans recommendations. On average, dietary fiber and iron intake densities were more than 20% below the recommended level. Meanwhile, calcium densities were closer to the recommended level, but still fell short. Total fat intake was within 20% of the highest recommendation, and the density of saturated fats for food away from home and densities of sodium from all sources were more than 20% above the recommendations. I'm Sabrina Halverson for Agnet West.
This is the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCowan. Recent harsh weather in significant parts of the Plains and Upper Midwest have caused the deaths of thousands of head of livestock. That means for many producers, the Livestock Indemnity Program might need to be used to help with the losses. What should you know about the Livestock Indemnity Program? I'll be back in a moment to discuss.
Kansas State University consistently ranks in the top 10 of all ag schools. 97% of K-State ag graduates are employed or furthering their education. Learn more at ag.ksu.edu.
I'll get back to the report in a moment, but I want you to know that Schrader Real Estate and Auction Company has sold farm and ranch land and farm equipment in 40 states. Learn how the Schrader family can help your family. Visit SchraderAuction.com. That's S-C-H-R-A-D-E-R Auction.com. What are the eligibility and compensation requirements of the Livestock Indemnity Program? For starters, you must file a notice with the local FSA office within 30 days of sustaining a covered loss. Make sure you document the number and kind of livestock lost and the event that caused the loss. If you sold the livestock to an independent third party, make sure you keep a record of the sale. A covered event includes just about any type of weather-related event, and covered livestock are cattle, swine, poultry, sheep, horses, goats, and bison. If you either own or contract grow the livestock, you're eligible under the program. If the loss is due to extreme cold, an animal's vaccination status doesn't matter, and disease losses are also covered. If you had death loss in your herd or flock, the death loss must exceed the normal mortality rate. Also, covered livestock are those that are maintained for commercial use as part of a farming operation. A LIP payment is based on national rates and is about 75% of market value. The USDA sets the per-head payment rate. This has been the Agricultural Law and Tax Report. I'm Roger McCowan.
Coming up later this month, member nations within the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework gather in Singapore for the latest round of negotiations.
At the end of last May, our leaders launched this framework work. In September, we hosted IPEF ministers at our first in-person ministerial in Los Angeles. Since then, we've already had two rounds of negotiations, one in Australia and one just last month in Indonesia.
U.S. Trade Representative Catherine Tai explaining the timeline of IPEF last month in Japan. The U.S. and Japan are two nations among the 14 making up this economic framework. Trade, supply chains, and clean energy are among the four pillars proposed for this framework. And while agriculture per se is not a pillar within the Indo-Pacific economic framework, there are opportunities for our nation's ag sector to benefit, according to Biden administration officials. That potential was on display in recent discussions between officials from the U.S. and other IPEF member nations. Ambassador Tai visited with officials in both the Philippines and Japan about the framework and upcoming negotiation round.
Since we launched the IPEF here in Tokyo less than a year ago, we have made very good progress in negotiating across a number of areas that will deliver tangible results to our workers and our businesses, including on trade facilitation, customs, and good regulatory practices.
The same week as the U.S. Trade Representative's Asian visit, Agriculture Secretary Tom Vilsack was also in the region, in part discussing IPEF with counterparts in Japan and Vietnam.
The trade pillar in particular, that framework, we believe, opens up a number of opportunities for additional market access.
Secretary Vilsack acknowledges that the Indo-Pacific Economic Framework is not a trade agreement in the traditional sense. However,
there's a tendency to place all the emphasis in discussions of trade on trade agreements as the only vehicle for opening up trade.
The secretary notes the recent opening of Vietnam's markets to U.S. grapefruit and stone fruit via dialogue as examples of advancing trade outside of a formal trade agreement. I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
Over the years, you've brought them into your home. You were prescribed opioids after the C-section and after Dad's back injury. They helped when you were in pain, and you held on to them just in case. But did you know holding on to unused opioids puts your family at risk? Trouble with opioids can start at home with unused medicines, such as pills, patches, and syrups. You can remove the risk and protect your family. Find out how at www.fda.gov/drugdisposal.
Welcome back to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West, providing you with statewide agriculture news daily. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Now let's listen in to more featured segments.
The lack of widespread weather issues around the country will make a rebound in the grain trade a much slower process. I'm Mark Oppold with the Bottom Line Report for this Thursday, brought to you by Superior Livestock. Corn futures look to end the week their lowest since mid-July a year ago. And while flooding continues along the Missouri and even more so along the Mississippi, aside from those areas, weather is more ideal, though cool soil temperatures cannot be ignored. Temperatures remain on the cooler side for emerging corn and soybeans, and agronomists suggest that will lead to uneven stands that could continue through the growing season. July corn low yesterday, 569 and a quarter, could be a longer-term low. And a close on July soybeans, again below 1413, certainly is negative technically. Palm oil, starting here the lowest since just after Labor Day a year ago. Superior Livestock offers three ways to sell your livestock: video auction, internet auctions, or the country page. Whether it's feeder cattle, dairy cattle, horses, or sheep, sell your livestock the Superior way. Learn more at SuperiorLivestock.com. Tight cattle supplies ahead may be offset by consumer resistance at the retail counter. Higher interest rates continue to squeeze the food dollar. I'm Mark Oppold, wishing you a profitable day.
And in more agriculture news, the National Association of Farm Broadcasting is working to keep auto manufacturers from removing AM radio in their new vehicles. Michael Clements has the report.
In response to automakers announcing the elimination of AM radio in select vehicles, the National Association of Farm Broadcasting is taking steps to keep AM radio in the dashboard. NAFB has spoken with the Federal Communications Commission and Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, as well as sent letters to leadership of the House and Senate Agriculture Committees. NAFB President Joe Gill says the focus right now is on educating others about the issue.
There's a lot of folks right now who are unaware of this issue, so educating our cohorts in the industry and also legislative leaders, because there is no legislation on the books regarding this issue. There is nothing to mandate this to be a item in vehicles.
Ford Motor Company will not have AM radio in most of its new 2024 vehicles, but will keep AM radio in commercial vehicles. Meanwhile, other companies like Tesla have already removed AM radio from their electric vehicles. Gill says the response so far has been overwhelmingly supportive of keeping AM radio.
You can't just plug in your phone or have an app because, let's face it, rural broadband is still not accessible in some areas. And once again, it comes down to safety as well when it comes to severe weather. And a lot of legislators did support us verbally, and they want to know what they can do to try and keep AM radio in the dashboard.
Gill says NAFB research shows the importance of AM radio to rural America.
As you look at some of the research on how many radios actually farmers and some of those folks have in their home, and the length of time that they listen, and how many days a week that they listen, and for some that is their only avenue for information. The top three things that are important to our listeners are markets and weather and local news, and to try and duplicate that in a different platform, I don't think is attainable.
He encourages rural America to provide more outreach moving forward as well.
I think as we move forward, we're going to be asking the listeners to maybe speak up to their local farm broadcasters, their local AM radio station, and also their leadership in Washington, D.C. as well, and tell them how important AM radio is to them.
NAFB is partnering with the National Association of Broadcasters and the National Alliance of State Broadcasters Association, who are both also advocating for keeping AM radio in vehicles. Michael Clements reporting.
And now, here's a story about not having to go to a restaurant, but instead having it come to you.
You can find any food you want at these mobile restaurants.
And of course, kids, we're talking about
food trucks.
Yes, food trucks. Is that going to happen every time we start to say food trucks? I guess it is.
Like a kitchen on wheels, serving snacks, serving meals for every kind of mood, a truck for every food, and he's always on the go.
Yes, this is one type of food service business that has really seen some good growth, even during the pandemic. In fact, these mobile meal makers have been on the rise, and one expert says, make no mistake.
It's definitely a long-term trend. It is not a fad.
That's Hudson Real with the National Restaurant Association. He was telling a Department of Agriculture conference the other day that since 2017, the number of these food vehicles in this country has grown by over 13.5%. There are now reportedly over 35,000 of these trucks operating in the U.S., and that number is climbing. And this growth coming from a couple of things. One, the sole entrepreneur who wants to get into the food service business but doesn't have the upfront capital for a traditional restaurant. But Hudson Real says some restaurant chains are getting into the cruising cuisine business as well.
Part of that has to do with the ability to enter new markets, test new markets, and even test new menu items to align with certain communities and demographic areas.
He says the rapid increase in the number of these trucks across the country may have a lot to do with how our society is changing, especially after COVID and the shutdown of thousands of traditional restaurants. In fact,
the definition of what constitutes a restaurant in America is rapidly changing.
Changing away from having to go and eat at a certain location. And in fact, actually, according to Hudson Real,
the term location has become somewhat antiquated. The industry now thinks about it in terms of points of access, and trucks represent another point of access for consumer to seek meal solutions away from home.
Meal solutions. Of course, these moving meal makers, modern chuck wagons, would not last long, though, if people didn't like the food. Hudson Real says in survey after survey, customers of these bustling bistros really like them. And so
mobile food service will continue to grow for sure.
You see how smart he is? He didn't say food trucks. Not once did he say it. Yeah. Okay. We got time for the closing now.
Like a kitchen on wheels, serving snacks, serving meals. He's a food truck, you know, and he's always on the go.
Time for us to go. This is Gary Crawford reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture. Food trucks. Oh, they must have been asleep.
Beep, beep.
No.
Beep, beep.
This is the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. We'll be back in just a moment with more of the day's national headlines and local reports when we return. But don't forget, if you've missed any of our morning shows or if you simply need to catch the news at a different time, you can always subscribe to our podcast and have statewide agriculture news at your convenience. All you have to do is search Agnet News Hour or Agnet West on your favorite podcast downloading app. That's Agnet News Hour. It's available on both Apple and Android devices.
How are GMO plants made? First, scientists look for a desired trait in a plant, animal, or even bacteria. It could be a trait like resistance to drought, insects, or viruses. Then they copy the gene that contains that trait and insert it into the DNA of the plant they want to improve. Scientists then grow that plant to see if it adopts the desired trait. Feed your mind with more GMO facts on FDA's website.
You've been listening to the Agnet News Hour by Agnet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now.
Today's specialty crop news brought to you by the Almond Board of California. You can find them online at almonds.com. We're joined once again by our friend Taylor Hillman, ABC Senior Specialist of Industry Communications. And today we're getting an update on the current election process for ABC's Board of Directors. And so, Taylor, let's start out with a recap of what these elections are exactly and the positions being voted on.
That's right, Brian. So the Almond Board of California Board of Directors elections is underway. Voting is underway. The election process starts way back in February, but ballots were officially mailed out to growers April 21st. So growers should have their information where they can cast their vote and be able to send those back in. There were several positions this year up for grabs. The independent grower number one spot, which is a one-year term. The independent grower number two alternate position, which remained empty last year and we're filling this year. And then the independent handler number one, which is a 3-year term, and the independent handler number three, which is a 1-year swing.
And now, since the last time we spoke, there are names now attached to these open positions, right?
Yeah, that's right. So on the ballots, you officially got to see the people who have put their name into the voting process. For the grower position number one, we have the incumbent, Paul Ewing, and then also Malvinder Singh Cahal has put his name in there. He's the petitioner. For the grower position number one alternate position, so the alternate to that member position I just read, again, we have the incumbent, Katie Stack. She is running unopposed. For the grower position number two alternate position only here, because we already have a member for this, we have Brad Klump. He is petitioner for this position. And Jamie Silva Estevez, she is also petitioner, as this position was vacant last year. There is 2 years remaining on this term. It was vacant last year and voted in then. This is a 3-year term, so there's two years left on that term. And then finally, on the other two handler positions that were open, handler position number one, member position, our board chair, current board chair, Alexi Rodriguez, she's the incumbent, she's running unopposed. And the alternate for that position, Ron Fisher, he is the incumbent, he is running unopposed. And then also for the handler position number three, member seat, Darren Rigg, he's the incumbent, he's running unopposed. And the handler position number three, alternate, which is Chad DeRose, he is the incumbent, and he is also running unopposed. So really, it's those grower positions that we will see that will have some voting to determine who remains in those seats.
So those ballots have gone out, but for anyone who believes that they should have gotten a ballot and maybe never received one, what's the process for finding out why that is, or maybe remedying the situation?
Yeah, so ballots go out to our list. Our list is the best we can put together from our handlers' list. Sometimes addresses can be wrong or need to be updated. It just happens. So if you're an almond grower listening to this and you did not receive a ballot April 21st or soon thereafter, go to our elections page at the Almond Board of California's website. That's almonds.com/elections. All the information is on there. You can contact our elections group and tell them that you did not receive a ballot, and we will get that out to you. You still have time to cast your vote. So if you did not get one, you can find that information on our website, almonds.com/elections.
And again, just to kind of reiterate and emphasize the timeline for those ballots, when are those going to need to be sent back in and received by the Almond Board to ensure those votes are counted?
Yeah, we're about halfway through the process right now. So ballots went out April 21st, and the last day for ABC to receive votes is May 25th. So you've got about a little over two weeks left to get your vote in. So again, go to almonds.com/elections. You can see the important dates. You can get all the information you need there. And remember to cast your vote. Your vote counts. We want to hear from you. Cast your vote by May 25th.
So still a decent amount of time to get those ballots sent back in there. And lastly, now, once all those votes are counted, what's the timeline for those results to come out?
June 1st is the day that we will announce the results from the election, June 1st. So the election's results will come out June 1st, and then the board will begin their new term August 1st. They will be seated at the August Board of Directors meeting. So again, May 25th is the last day to vote. The election results will be announced June 1st, and then August 1st is when the new terms begin, and the board will be seated in that month.
You're listening to AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leo. We'll be right back in just a moment with more agriculture news.
Farm employers' labor service compliance posters could save you thousands of dollars. Did you know that California lawmakers can be fined as much as $13,000 in government penalties if they don't have all the required employee and farm labor information posted for their workers? Avoid costly penalties and give yourself peace of mind knowing you are in full compliance with FELS posters. At only $175, this full set of laminated weatherproof posters eliminates the risk. Order yours at FELS.net.
You've been listening to the AgNet News Hour by AgNet West. I'm your host, Danielle Leal. Welcome back. We've got more of the day's agriculture news right now. New leadership selected for the AgOne Foundation Board of Directors. Earlier this week, a new group of ag advocates were selected to lead the AgOne Foundation at Fresno State. Roger Isom, President and CEO of Western Agricultural Processors Association, as well as the California Cotton Growers and Ginners Association, has served on the board of directors for 6 years and was selected this week as the role of president. Isom says, quote, "This is truly an honor and a privilege to be associated with such a dedicated board and team, helping students in JCAS achieve their dreams and help agriculture remain viable for the next generation." Joining Isom as officers is Vice President Nick Biscay of Stanislaus Farm Supply. The treasurer is Finley Ragland of PGIM Real Estate Agricultural Investments. And the secretary is Jason Baldwin of Pinoche Creek Packing. The foundation was founded in 1979, and it benefits, promotes, and supports the Jordan College of Agriculture, as well as its programs. And collectively, the foundation has raised more than $27 million in endowed funds. Over the years, roughly 5,000 students have received upwards of $8.5 million in scholarships and program support. And for this year, the 2022-23 academic year, AgOne will provide more than $850,000 to deserving students and programs. If you'd like to find out more information on the foundation, you can visit jcast.fresnostate.edu/AgOne Foundation.
Researchers are now confident that there are herbicide resistance issues with common chickweed in small grain production. Cooperative Extension Farm Advisor Nick Clark said that after multiple studies looking at the potential for resistance, they have reached a definitive answer.
When we talked earlier, we had only done it one time. We were not getting control, but because we're scientists, we like to do things over and over again to really reduce the probability that we did something wrong. So we repeated that study two more times. So we did it a total of 3 times. And each time we did it, we were not able to control the chickweed from several fields with a handful of those different ALS inhibitor herbicides. So since we've last talked, me and Dr. Anil Shrestha over at Fresno State and Dr. Catherine Wasilkov over at Fresno State have all concluded definitively that yes, there are some populations of common chickweed in California that we have found in small grain crops which are resistant to certain ALS inhibitor herbicides. That's been documented now. And as far as we can tell, it's the first documented case west of the Rocky Mountain Range in North America. So, you know, that is what it is.
UC Davis will be hosting a Small Grains and Alfalfa Forages Field Day next week. Supported by the California Crop Improvement Association, the field day will be taking place in the Department of Plant Sciences Field Facility at UC Davis on Thursday, May 11th. The first part of the morning will include an alfalfa forage biofuel field tour with presentations on variety selection for pest resistance, weed identification, and overhead irrigation technologies. The Small Grains Field Tour part of the morning will include a small grain research update from Tule Lake, information on biosolids as a nitrogen fertilizer, and updates on small grain research and production in the Central Valley. After lunch, the Small Grains Breeding Program Field Day will take place with several updates on a variety of programs. More information on the field day is available on the upcoming events page at agnetwest.com. I'm Brian German for AgNet West Radio Network.
The president of the American Farm Bureau speaks to the Senate. Senate Agriculture Committee lawmakers heard from farmers and ranchers during a Farm Bill hearing Tuesday. American Farm Bureau Federation President Zippy Duval shared with the committee the challenges farmers and ranchers are facing.
Like rising interest rates, production expense that keeps increasing year after year, but also told them about the opportunities ahead of us.
Duval says there are several investments farmers and ranchers need from the Farm Bill.
We'll need investments into agriculture's research, investment in voluntary incentive-based conservation programs, and investment to ensure those facing hunger have access to nutritious food that farmers are dedicated to producing. All of these investments come through the Farm Bill. But nearly half of all of our Congress has never worked on a Farm Bill process before. And it is more important than ever that farmers and ranchers use their voice to help Congress understand the importance of the Farm Bill.
I'm Sabrina Halverson for the Southeast AgNet.
Hot western temperatures and cool mountain snowpack. USDA meteorologist Brad Rippey discusses the recent high temperatures we've experienced here in California, as well as the impacts it's had on our mountain snowpack.
Over the last week or so, we have seen some of that very warm weather in the western U.S., temperatures reaching into the 90-degree range in parts of the Pacific Northwest, 95 or higher in California's Central Valley, and even some 100-degree-plus readings in the desert Southwest. All of that late April warmth was pretty efficient at melting high-elevation snowpack. Water is heavily managed in much of the west for the most part, snowmelt flooding concerns remaining under control, but that continues to be an issue as we move into the later spring time period with higher sun angle, a very hot sun this time of year, and with temperatures elevated, that is creating some issues for water managers in the west, trying to balance that rapid snowmelt with holding on to as much water as possible for summer, at the same time trying to keep communities below dams and reservoirs safe from the heavy flow of melting snow. A little bit of a challenge right now in the west as the cooler air moves in this week, that is favorable for slowing down the snow melt a little bit.
To get more information on the topics you heard today, visit AgNet West online at agnetwest.com. You can also stay connected by following us on our social media at AgNet West on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can also find our broadcast team of Danielle Leal, Brian German, and Sabrina Halvertson on Facebook and Twitter. Thank you for listening to the AgNet News Hour from AgNet West. AgNet West Radio Network, your primary choice for agriculture news.